Hi, I'm Mike Kramer from Brotherhood Mutual Insurance Company. I'm a manager in the Casualty Claims Department. In part one of our podcast, Violence in Our Schools, we discussed how to change the school's mindset from reacting to violence to preventing it. In this podcast, we'll talk about free and low-cost tools your school can use, background checks, and threat management teams. Our guest is Mike McCarty, CEO and founder of Safe Hiring and Safe Visitor Solutions. Mike's background is in law enforcement, threat assessment, and training. Hi, Mike. Let's continue the conversation.
Sure.
What do you feel should be in a school safety toolkit?
The toolkit's going to be big. It's a big bag because first we have to understand that school security, it's an ongoing process. This is not a carpenter that comes in with a toolkit, gives you everything you need immediately, and walks away in 2 months and you're done. This is ongoing, everlasting process. But some of the key things that need to be in the toolkit are obviously your policies and procedures. We've talked a lot about that. The vulnerability assessment is the main component. Could be social media monitoring tools, emergency communication tools. When I talk about emergency communication, there's some new tools that are coming out on the market that actually a school can run a mobile application. Employees can place this application on their phone. Law enforcement officers, I think there's some 50,000, and one of them we've evaluated already, have this mobile application on their phones, on duty, off duty. In the crisis situation, if they are to hit a button, then this goes out to anybody that's geographed, geofenced in an area so they can have quicker response times. Anonymous tip lines, see something, say something. There are companies, many of them out here already exist in the marketplace where I can text in, because we have to put it in a medium that kids are going to use. My kids would rather text me from the other room than to walk in and ask me for something. So I need to be able to anonymously, you know, say, hey, I heard this or I saw this. I know we saw an incident in Georgia within the last year that was prevented based on a student making an anonymous tip. And with that anonymous tip, they went and searched a locker and found a weapon. So these tools help, but they have to be anonymous. They also allow me to be able to communicate if I'm feeling depressed or potentially suicidal. So we've seen some of these tools that now are evolving into connecting with your crisis or care team, creating kind of an incident report that comes in. If it's real time based on certain words, can immediately connect them with a crisis team. So those communication tools, and I saw one the other day where they created it with Google themselves. I don't know how they did it. I just saw it on a survey that we conducted. So it doesn't mean you have to buy one, but create a medium for them to report. Background checks. What are you doing? Just to say you're doing background checks, that's not enough. What type of background checks? How frequently? What level? When you're talking about volunteers or contractors or having contact with your students, you know, how are you vetting them? How are you screening them? Are you going with a $7 background check? That's probably not the tool that's going to combat what needs to happen. I would also say reference checks needs to be in that. Why would I say reference checks? Well, 80% of sex offenders in the United States don't have a criminal history. So I'm not going to uncover them with a criminal check alone. And so I need other tools to be able to uncover that. These are the kind of things, access control systems, IP cameras. Not all of these are going to be things you implement today. Matter of fact, when we look at a toolkit, there's a whole group of things that we would say, here's where you want to start based on some recommendations. And these are things you can do tomorrow because they're free. Having an adult at the front door, one way in, one way out. So you have one single access point. You know, that was the problem in Parkland. You had multiple ways in, all doors opened up in between classes. I mean, trying to manage that is impossible. And so looking at, you know, any kind of environmental design around your front door, what may look really pretty may also hinder security. Big bushes, tall bushes, places where people can hide within those bushes. So looking at some of the environmental designs, how do you control people when they walk in the front door? One of the things in a toolkit that you want to take a look at is if your school, if you walk in the front door and you're immediately in the swimming pool, so to speak, there's no barriers, is long term, how do we, you know, barrier off that front entryway to where we let you through one set of doors, but you're not getting to the kids until we allow you into those next set of doors, or what barriers can we create? So those are the kind of things that are in this security toolkit, and they range from things we can do today for free to things it's going to take years potentially and an architect to be able to change on a design feature.
Since you work with a lot of ministries, and we obviously are connected to a lot of ministries, there's that balance between truth and grace, and there's that balance between a legal responsibility and a moral responsibility. Are you recommending, or is there a recommendation that they need to go beyond $7?
You haven't heard me say anything about liability. And one of the reasons I haven't talked anything about liability is because we really approach this from a moral standpoint. You have a moral obligation. I don't care if you're a private or a public school, you've got a mission to protect these children in the school. And so if that threshold of protection is only being driven by liability, you're going to fall low on this scale. And what we want to talk through is with those organizations that are really mission driven about protecting children, protecting their school, their team, here's where you need to start. Very difficult with a $7 background check. Very difficult to run a sex offender registry check and be 100% certain that somebody walking through your door is not a sex offender. Why? Because it depends what part of the country you're in. Indiana, where we set again, many sex offenders only required to register for 10 years, then they can fall off the registry. You go to Massachusetts, they have three classifications on their sex offender registry. Not all three classifications actually report to the sex offender registry. So those tools are not going to be competitive products for keeping these type of people out of your organization. And so, no, you can't do it for $7. What we can do is show you what a best practice is. You can go on our website right now and download a 10 things you need to know before you hire a background screening firm. And it doesn't tell you who to hire. What it tells you, these are the questions you need to ask, and they need to be able to answer these questions, or you need to move on to the next provider.
What can we ask parents and area businesses that can help our school achieve greater security?
Good question. Two parts. The businesses can be a great set of eyes. And I know one of the security directors, large public school that we work with, often talks about the relationship she's building with businesses that are actually next door to school buildings that they have. They see things, if they see things that are anomalies, that they don't look right, that they're calling her and letting her know. And so it's an extra set of eyes. Businesses can also be engaged to help with the toolkit. They have a huge vested interest in schools in their community. And so oftentimes we don't think about, you know, how do I pay for IP cameras or social media monitoring solutions? A lot of times you can tap into local businesses that are more than willing philanthropically to support those kind of safety measures for the school. Parents, this is an important piece, I think, to the whole security process is, one, engaging the parents. How do you communicate with the parents? They're scared. They really are. Going back into school session this year, parents are nervous. They're nervous because of the incidents that happened back in late winter and the spring. And so being able to host meetings as an administrator, bringing in your law enforcement officers that are your partners, explaining what you're doing right now, where you're going, what you're looking at, and also telling them, I can't tell you everything we're doing, because there's some things we're doing that if I tell you, will totally turn the process into a process that no longer works. Parents also can be become advocates. I've seen it in communities recently where a grandmother in a community is now the one raising funds because she thinks that every school, not only in the district where her grandkids are at, but now she's doing it throughout the whole county. She thinks every one of those schools needs to have metal detectors, and she's the one raising the funds for those metal detectors. And so parents need to be engaged. I would also say engage your students. Students need to play an active part in this security process. We're working with a school right now that had an active shooter incident this year, and they're creating a student advisory group. Why? Those kids know everything that's happening in the school. You know, if I ask my kids questions, they know everything that's happening at school. None of us know these things. And so really engaging business, parents, and the students, and I think you've just hit the trifecta right there.
How do you balance this fear trying to lead to control compared to what we preach, surrender, safety, and then faith?
Yeah, wow, what a great question. You know, I would say we're all feeling fear right now, and a lot of that's just because it's just being perpetuated in the media. A lot of vendors right now perpetuating a lot of fear, trying to sell product. But we also live in a free society. And so part of living in a free society is we understand that we can't be driven, we can't live by fear. I can honestly say I've been through life events, lost a first wife with three little kids. And the last thing I want is my kids to live a life of fear and be fearful of what's going to happen to me someday. And so we've spent years talking through, you can't live a life of fear. And so I think that's where your faith comes into play here is, you know, nobody wants to operate in fear. And we don't do anything here trying to scare anybody into doing anything. These are just steps that are morally logical steps that we need to take. Even in a church environment that can be open at times on the church side, steps that we need to take because we do have a duty to protect anybody that's coming in here. And we are a target sometimes.
How do you go in when you're training staff about being open and communicating things that, one, are potentially harmful to them? Do you find that there is a way to help individuals overcome that fear or barrier of opening up about something like that?
Yeah, I've spent most of my career working in domestic violence. I helped start one of the first domestic violence community-based units in Nashville back in the early 90s. So there's a fear of reporting in general, both with domestic violence or we're talking about sexual misconduct, either one, really low report rates. So the first thing is trust. I have to know as an employee, if I come to you, Mike, and disclose to you that I'm having marital problems, there's violence in the relationships or threats of violence in the relationship, I have to trust that if I give you that information, you're going to handle it correctly. You're not going to share that with people that don't need to know that information. But I also need to know as an employee that I have an obligation and a duty to the people and the students in this school that if I'm in danger, they're in danger as well. And so a lot of times it's just really looking at it from a policy standpoint. Most of the times schools will have a misconduct policy, you know, you got an emergency plan, you got safety plans, but a lot of times we don't see a lot of policy around how you handle those interpersonal issues that are happening at home. That's really one of the largest volume crimes we have in the United States. And quite honestly, when we look at workplace violence in general, that's the greatest risk we face in a workplace is the interpersonal violence coming to work. Way more likely that that's going to happen than an active shooter incident.
Would you say then that I use a statistic when I'm talking with ministries that most active shooter or deadly force incident, the perpetrator or the violent offender is known to the ministry. Do you feel like the numbers bear that out, or that's a true statement?
It's interesting with domestic violence that they may not be known outside the home sometimes. Although it's interesting when you've had these really incidents that may have ended in a murder, when you talk to neighbors, and a lot of times they'll have some indications, but they really haven't, you know, said anything. But when you look at domestic violence or any type of violence, there are predictable behaviors. They're not impulsive crimes. They're well thought out. I mean, for 25 years, all I've ever heard about domestic violence is you cannot prevent it. This is a crime of passion. This person becomes inflamed over dinner or house cleaning or any number of different things. They lose control and they commit this crime, which is totally not true. We've looked at hundreds and hundreds of what we would call fatality reviews, and almost always there is a history and weeks, months, or years of violence that predicate that actual murder. And so it's understanding that violence in general is highly unlikely that we come in contact with a very impulsive crime.
Parkland, Santa Fe, Texas, the Charleston church shooting, they're all kids. How much history do maybe those kids have, or how do our ministries and schools become in tune to that limited history so that they can be diligent in identifying what may be a potentially harmful individual?
Yeah, and I think this goes right along the question you asked earlier. We've got to get a lower threshold for threats and violence. And I think we've moved in that direction over the last 10 years with these anti-bullying campaigns, and what we're starting to tolerate's a lot less. But we've got to get there faster. And schools have to create what I would call a crisis team or a care team. But it's really, if you want to scrape all the ribbons off of it, this is a threat management team. This is a team that could involve law enforcement, counselors, administrators, social worker. Each team can be a little bit different depending on that school, but we have to have a team that's responsible for dealing all aspects of this. Could be suicide prevention, the bullying behaviors, because one thing we know with the active shooters is many of them have had suicidal thoughts. A lot of what we see with the shooters is bullying type behaviors have led them into some kind of targeted violence, not necessarily directed at any one kid when they go into that school, but the institution itself. And so we need more training. We have to understand how all of these things fit together, and what maybe I'm seeing out of a seventh grader, a behavior, how over a long period of time could evolve. Doesn't mean it's going to evolve into an active shooter, but it could evolve into other unhealthy behaviors. And so how do we identify those, and then how do we provide solutions for those?
It sounds like it's not all a burden that a classroom teacher needs to be carrying. Are you recommending, or do you recommend, that these individuals who are reviewing that information be a separate committee or entity or force?
Yeah, most of the teams that we work with in schools or help develop, a lot of times it's not the teacher. They've got a lot on their plate. And so we're bringing in a team. Typically, it's going to be administrators. When I say administrators, that might be a principal, an assistant principal, a guidance counselor, a school resource officer, or law enforcement that works with your school. And so that team is going to be kind of a multidisciplinary response. Because I think the biggest gap we're seeing right now with schools is I have schools tell me all the time, public and private, we're pretty good at identifying kids in need. The problem is the failure within the community when we make that referral. And so how we're bringing this all together, because we can't afford to have failures when we're referring a child that needs help.
We'd mention police officers or uniformed officers being the highest deterrent. What is it for schools and ministries that you see as maybe the second thing that would have an offender or an avenger opt out when they see it or when they hear it?
Yeah, and you bring up a good point, or I had a thought, when you talk about having officers in the schools, especially from the private school side, where the SRO programs aren't nearly as big as they are in a public school environment. We've been helping some private schools adopt those programs. We've been working with NASRO, and how do you do that? And thinking outside the box a little bit, and how do you create an environment where you have even retirees that become special deputies on a local department, so they're still now activated and allowed to carry weapons, and convert them to school resource officers. So, you know, looking and thinking outside the box, if you're a school that's sitting here today and say, we don't even have an officer in the school, I need number one before we get to number two, is just thinking outside the box a little bit and recognizing how we can do this. And it's a little different than creating that relationship, you know, that a public school might have with the local police, because that one's usually a 50-50 split. The school pays 50% of the police officer, and the agency pays 50%. So that can get a little bit expensive. But there's ways of doing that.
So what would you say then the next thing that is out there that you see has the Avenger opt out? If it's not an SRO or if it's not an officer, is it the buzzer? Is it the gate?
It's staff. And those high traffic times in the morning and afternoon, it's the presence. I mean, it's the same thing. I was driving through North Carolina and tapped the brakes because evidently I was speeding. And because I saw the car in the median. Well, there wasn't anybody in the car. I thought, oh, that's really smart. Just the presence of that car, and we're all tapping our brakes. Seeing somebody standing in front of that door, even if it's not a uniformed police officer, changes my mindset completely. And so that's what we're talking about. One way in, one way out, and having an adult presence during those passing periods. And that's that sounds easier than it is to do, because a lot of times you're teaching. You were a teacher. Yep. They're grabbing you after class. I mean, ask you a question. You know, being in the hallways, being at those doors, that presence alone is a mitigator.
I know you talk about working backwards, which sounds counterintuitive, but can you talk about, instead of using words like moving forward, starting something, what working backwards is?
Yeah, I think the concept of working backwards in a school setting is because fear and this pressure has driven a lot of schools to do things over the last several years. Not always the things that needed to happen first, is now a lot of them are stepping back and saying, I need to get back here. I need to figure out, where's my level playing field? Where's that vulnerability assessment? Where do I start and start moving forward again? And that's the fear we have right now in a world where there's so much pressure on schools coming from so many directions to do something and do things I can see, that we don't want them doing things that in 2 years we look at it and go, you need to really come back here and start here again. And that's where communicating with parents, really, you know, understanding that vulnerability assessment, how it plays into it, so you start where you should start, and then start moving that security plan forward. You cannot bite this whole thing off at once, no possible way. And so, you know, understanding that this is a long marathon, it's not a sprint.
What are you hearing back from schools who have been implementing your suggestions?
It's all positive, and I think the feedback, because we're usually communicating with the administrators, and the feedback they're getting is not resistance. And I think there's always been a fear, if we're doing a lot of these things, we're going to get resistance from some of the rank and file. And that's not at all what we're getting back from our administrators. They're getting support. The teachers are supportive of this. It's having a real cultural change within the school. And it really sets the tone, because what you're saying is safety is a priority. And it's one thing to say it in a bunch of paper. It's another thing when you start implementing real change and real policies. And it'll have a trickle-down effect all the way through the school, not just through the staff, but all the way through the students as well.
How much time do you say that the schools need to give themselves once change is implemented for it to become normal?
It's an ongoing process. And so as you make changes, you're going to have to continue to support those changes. So the training becomes a huge component here. And this is ongoing. You're not going to have one training event where you talk through active shooter for civilians or sexual misconduct or whatever you're training on. The kind of suitcase training mentality doesn't work. It has to be ingrained in the culture. On the public school side, we see a lot of these types of trainings being mandated now across the country. Annual events from anti-bullying, I mean, even bloodborne pathogens, all kinds of different training requirements. And so this type of training that supplements this new security program needs to be part of the actual ongoing curriculum.
Thank you, Mr. McCarty, for coming in. We're extremely blessed that you've brought in your time and your talent to us. We want to thank everybody for listening in. We trust that you came away with an incredible amount of information, some tools for your toolkit to go back to your school and to implement and make that initial impact. Thank you so much for your listening ear. And we again just want to thank Mike McCarty here from Safe Visitors for being with us.